Welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of Dr. Martin Luther King's insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of episode 3 in the series. This is part 2 of my interview with well-known peace activist Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We resume with Kathy Kelly talking about her activism in the mid-1990s.
Well, this again, Jack, was a time in my life when I was involved in something that was too little and too late. But by 1995, we realized that two elderly sisters, Eileen Story and Anne Montgomery, little tiny nuns, but very vibrant, vital people, would beg us. They'd come back from having visited the religious orders that they were connected to in Iraq, and they would say to us, you know, somebody's got to do something. Well, by that time, I'm taking care of my elderly father. I'm very much involved in a number of different kinds of disarmament efforts. We were increasingly aware of the Palestinian suffering under Israeli oppression, And I honestly thought, well, you know, what can we do? And we finally, at Christmas time, got together in 1995, about 12 of us. And we agreed we wouldn't leave my kitchen table until we had come up with some kind of a plan to oppose the economic sanctions. And then it got really easy, actually, because we realized we couldn't become a humanitarian relief group. You know, we couldn't afford more than, you know, a few things of aspirin. But what we did know how to do was engage in nonviolent civil resistance. And how could we nonviolently resist the economic sanctions? Well, we could break them. We could take medicines and medical relief supplies to Iraq. And we vowed we would do that. And we wrote a letter to the United States government, to the Treasury Department, and we told them that our plan was to travel as often as we possibly could, carrying medicines and medical relief to children and families in Iraq. And we immediately got word back, you do this, and you risk 12 years in prison, a $1 million fine, a $250,000 administrative penalty. And we wrote back and we thanked them for the clarity of their warning. We said we understood the penalties before we got started on this, and we invited them to join us. We said we wouldn't be governed by unjust laws. So the first delegation to actually go over to Iraq to break the economic sanctions was a small delegation. I was part of it, and it turned out I was the only one who was allowed in initially. And so I was by myself in Baghdad and kind of begging officials over there to try and understand this project. Well, you know, this is a dictatorship. And when you go over and say, we want to break laws, people think, well, we want to get as far away from you as we possibly can. But we finally did find some people that understood what we were trying to do. And my colleagues were allowed to come into the country. And bit by bit, we pieced together the means to, upon arrival in Iraq, visit with hospitals, visit with families, go down to Basra, go up to Mosul. And it didn't take long at all for any delegation from the United States to understand the hideous cruelty of the economic sanctions. And so we organized 70 delegations to go to Iraq from 1996 until the war broke out in 2003. And some delegations would stay longer than others. Normally, people stayed 10 to 14 days. One time, I and others were able to stay in Basra for 2.5 months for an entire summer. We started to realize how hard, how very, very hard life was under those economic sanctions with no electricity, very minimal food, horrible hospital conditions. And yet, people embraced us, welcomed us. It may sound unbelievable, but you'd go into a hospital ward, a pediatrics ward, and the mothers would pull us into the beds with them where they sat cross-legged holding their infants. And they would stroke us and beg us, go back to your country. Tell the mothers in your country, we pray this will never happen to them. And then they would be weeping over the infant they held in their arms, knowing that they'd never bring that baby out of the hospital. All of those children died.
And not knowing that within a matter of a few years, the Americans would be back again, and this time with greater force and ferocity that Iraq probably has ever seen. Between that time, though, and the war of 2003, shock and awe, when you were there right in Baghdad when the troops came, wasn't there a time before that that you were also involved with the School of the Americas, or was that after your shock and awe experience? I forget, Kathy Kelly, when it was that you eventually did a direct action at the United States Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Well, that was following the 2003 war.
Okay, well, let's go into the 2003 war then, and tell us how you ended up back in Iraq as shock and awe began. Could you tell us that particular story?
Well, in August of 2002, a number of us got together in Chicago, and we looked at each other and said, "Look, you know, we can't kid ourselves. The United States is on a footing to go to war against Iraq, and how could we go and leave, you know, just because we have blue passports? What if we constituted ourselves as a peace team and declared our intent to stay in Baghdad?" So it was quite an organizing effort. I'm so grateful to quite a number of people who you know, made that the number one priority in their lives and did everything they could to steadily send delegations over to Iraq that would say, you know, we plan to remain if the war breaks out. Well, you know, people couldn't indefinitely stay, many of them. So there were quite a few delegations that went and then returned to the United States. But at the time when it was looking like war was imminent, we had, I think, about 20 people in place, and we were there in two different hotels, the Al-Dar Hotel and the Al-Fanar Hotel, on the night that the 2003 shock and awe bombing began. And it was shocking, and it was awful. The first 3 days, not so bad, really. You still saw traffic. People still went to marketplaces. But after the third day, the United States Air Force began to hurl down on Baghdad every kind of missile and weapon that they had in their entire arsenal. And the explosions were deafening. They were gut-wrenching. They were ear-splitting. And we were with families in the Al-Fanar Hotel. I remember two little girls. I would put one in each arm. They were so tiny, and walk the halls with them. While their mother was just in abject, utter fear.
And there were some other Americans in Brits, maybe some Aussies that I vaguely remember that were there with you in that hotel too, weren't they?
Well, we've certainly had one of the finest teams I could ever imagine being with. The Australian mentor to our group, Neville Watson, was a pivotal figure for all of us. And Ed Kanan from Syracuse, New York, was a very, very strong figure. Kathy Breen from the New York Catholic Worker, Ramzi Kaisia, very dedicated member of that team.
Cynthia Banis was
Cynthia Banis was, they called her Madame Cynthia, and she was beloved, utterly beloved by all, by the workers in the hotel, by the children. I remember one night, Cynthia would sometimes go down into the bomb shelter with the mothers and children. It was just four steps down and, you know, a number of prayer mats. It wasn't much of a bomb shelter. But the kids, the teenage kids, liked to stay up. And this is kind of ironic. They liked to play the game Risk. And they played it again and again and again. And Cynthia, knowing that, you know, some of the parents were worn out and tired and the moms wanted to go to sleep, said in her own way, "You know, you could always finish that game tomorrow." And little Dima looked at her and said, "Oh, but Madame Cynthia, we might not be here tomorrow." And Cynthia began to cry. And it was Cynthia, when the Marines arrived in Baghdad, And they were lined up outside looking up at us on the second floor balcony, like, we might be people who landed in a spaceship. They were pretty unsure, whatever in the world to say to us after all of this god awful bombing and invasion. Cynthia looked at me at one point and she said, "They look awfully thirsty, don't they?" And the next thing I knew, I said it to her. I said, "Cynthia, they look awfully thirsty, don't they?" And she said, "I'm so glad you said that. Of course, that's the right thing to do." And she walked over to where we had big six packs of bottled water stacked up almost 3/4 of the way up the wall. And she pulled down two heavy six packs of bottled water and trudged out to meet the newly arrived Marines.
Wow. Wow. That's an image. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. With her pink hat, her code pink hat, and her "War is not the answer" t-shirt. And I remember I kind of froze. I thought, we should have a meeting about this. What do we all think about this? And then I realized every family in Baghdad, in Basra, in Mosul, in the poorest of areas, amongst people who were nearly homeless, if we crossed into their door, they sat us down, tried to make hot water for tea, often would send the youngest child out to get a Pepsi, and said, "Tafadl, sit down, have tea, hold our babies, sleep on our rooftops." So I went and got some water and followed Cynthia. And for the next, 8 to 10 days, there were the most extraordinary conversations with those Marines.
They must have been, I can just imagine the Marines, U.S. Marines, finding this woman from Chicago and this woman who is a librarian, an elderly woman. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think she might have been retired by then as a school librarian from Utica, taking them out of water. That must have been. But you said that it went on then. You got to know them over a period of some days or weeks.
Well, that's true. Kathy Breen has a very quiet way of sharing her own prayerfulness. And so she had a missalette. And she would go down and kneel down and read the readings for the day. And I remember several times Marines coming up to her, putting their hands in hers and saying, "Ma'am, would you pray with me?" The stories that we heard certainly deepened our sense of compassion for anybody who goes through boot camp and is trained up to be part of the United States military. Now, I don't believe that people go into those situations thinking, "I want to become a killer." But I do believe that many, many of them struggle with moral injury for the rest of their lives after they have, in point of fact, become killers. And there was great remorse expressed.
So there's so much, there's so many layers to your life of direct nonviolent action. But after you came back, I know you were back many times to Iraq and eventually into Afghanistan, which we'd like to have you tell us a bit about. But if you could tell us what your nonviolent direct action was at the School of the Americas, the school that you just explained was where Latinos were taught in methods of assassination and torture and various other nasty things that right at just a small part of this huge infantry base, the largest infantry base in the United States, maybe the world, at in Columbus, Georgia, at Fort Benning. You went down there and tell us about, what went on with you and Roy and others, if you can.
Well, by 2004, some of the finest peacemakers in the United States were assembling in the thousands at the gates of Fort Benning. And my sense when I came back to the United States after living in Iraq through the Shock and Awe bombing was that I simply couldn't be at liberty in this country if that would seem that I in any way was in compliance with the will of the country in going to war against Iraq in the Shock and Awe bombing and in the subsequent occupation following on the years of economic sanctions. So I went to Fort Benning knowing that these wars are all of a piece, that the same war that was going on to control resources in Central America was linked to the war that I had just returned from. And I wanted to be part of the civil disobedience action. And beyond that, to be honest, Jack, when I crossed that line at Fort Benning, it really wasn't for me much more dramatic than crossing the line at O'Hara Airport for the TSA search. I think I was daydreaming about other things. I had had time to think about this. I knew I wanted to be part of the action. But then I got into a large gymnasium where the people who'd been arrested were being processed. And that's, you know, also familiar to me, kind of like, as I mentioned, it's like O'Hare Airport. And I was cooperating, but I looked around the room and I saw that in every spot were each of about 15 different searches of activists were going on. The soldiers were belting out the orders and everybody was complying. And my personal experience was that it was the most aggressive search I'd ever experienced. You know, hands inside of clothing and squeezing and kind of humiliating. And the high school study teacher in me came out and I turned my head. You know, I had lifted my arms and my legs were spread apart, but I turned toward the soldier barking the orders and I asked, "Could you help me understand why you're screaming at me?" He then said in a very loud voice, shouted, "Raise your arms higher, spread your legs further." And the search continued and something came over me that I'm not surprised by really. I just decided, oh, I shouldn't go along with this. And so I very quietly said, "I'm not going to cooperate with this any longer." And I began to lower my arms. Well, as soon as my arms were lowered, I found myself on the floor. I was thrown to the floor. I had a black eye from the impact. My wrists were immediately tied, as were my ankles. And then my wrists and ankles were tied together. And a very large soldier was kneeling on me and calling me this fucker. And I'd never been treated like that before. I realized that I wasn't going to stay conscious for much longer. I was having a difficult time breathing. So I said as much, no results. So I said it again, "Excuse me, you're hurting me and I can't breathe." Nothing. And so then I managed to say, "Look, I've had four lung collapses in the past. Now, it's due to congenitally diseased tissue and my lungs have been sort of sewn up. There's no way they could collapse." But I said that, and I think they didn't want a dead pacifist on their hands. And so the person kneeling on me got a signal from the person conducting the search and got up off of me. And as things go, I was okay. Now, I want to interject right there. Had I been black and said, "I can't breathe," repeatedly, I wonder if I'd be alive.
Right, right, for sure. So you eventually were charged with a crime. Could you tell us what the crime was and what the result of all this was?
Well, I was sentenced to criminal trespass to a military institution, and I was sentenced to 3 months in prison. And then a fourth month was added on for another similar trespass in Wisconsin. And anyway, I was sent off to prison at Pekin Prison in Peoria, Illinois. And it turned out that fourth month, the judge never filed the paperwork on time, so that was dropped. And I served 3 months in federal prison then. And then again in 2015, I served 3 months in prison for crossing the line at the Whiteman Air Force Base, which was operating drones and still is operating drones over Afghanistan. And I wanted to bring a loaf of bread to the commander of that base. So I have had a fairly consistent opportunity to become educated about the wrongfulness of the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex.
Tell us a bit about that, especially the women that you encountered there.
Well, my sentences were so short. You know, the first time I went to prison for a year, some of the other women, they called me Missiles for short. They say, "Missiles, you ain't nothing but a minute. You know, you're in a revolving door." But you get the hang of what onerous, horrible separations happen to women who are cruelly, cruelly separated from their children, from their communities. Many of them had a problem with either the use or sale of drugs, but often that was rooted in economic despair. And I think many, many people, without any other means to dig themselves out of extreme poverty, might have gotten involved in the only industry that was going on in their neighborhood. And I met some of the kindest people, some of the most beautiful people in the world. It was a world of imprisoned beauty, whether I was at Lexington or Pekin or in county jails. I never met the bad sisters. I don't know where they keep them. I just didn't meet them.
Yeah. Now, Kathy, now we're into a situation where you seem to change countries. You decide that it's about time to go to Afghanistan. When did all this develop? If you can keep us into a year, some sort of chronology about your nonviolent direct action. When was that you went to Afghanistan?
Well, from 2003, the shock and awe bombing, until 2009, we did go over to Gaza, for instance, and to Palestine. We were starting to branch out, I suppose, a little bit, knowing that, as I mentioned before, these wars are all of a piece. And we couldn't just, pretend Gazans weren't being horribly maimed and brutalized and killed and attacked with awful munitions like white phosphorus made in the United States. So we had taken those steps, but at one point we were intent on walking from Chicago to Minneapolis in advance of the Republican National Convention that was being held in Minneapolis in 2008. And a very good friend of ours, an imam, said, in all these years that I've known you, I've helped commission you and your group to various places, but never have you ever paid any attention to Afghanistan. And he was right. Following 9/11, a number of us in 2001 had organized a walk from the Pentagon to the United Nations carrying a banner that said, "Our grief is not a cry for war." But we'd never made it, part of our focus to actually go to Afghanistan and learn from people in Afghanistan or Pakistan. And at that point, you may know of Jeremy Scahill, and we were so fond of Jeremy. He'd been with us in Iraq many, many times, and he paid a visit to Voices, and he sat in my kitchen. I just never forget this. He pounded on our wooden kitchen table, and he asked us, "When, Kathy, are you and this group going to get in touch with 21st century military practices?" And I said, "Well, soon." And that's when we started to research drone warfare and started to realize that, in fact, the United States military wouldn't need to send a conscripted army or a volunteer army to many of the war zones. They could just send the troops into dimly lit trailers and, as pilots trained a bit like video gamers, practice and then eventually use drones to assault and kill people in other lands without ever leaving the trailer, without ever leaving the United States. So we knew that a lot of those attacks were happening in Pakistan. And so with the Imam's blessing, Imam Abdul Malik Mujahid, a number of us made two trips in succession over to Pakistan, got to know survivors of drone attacks, learned a lot about Pakistani peace movement people, including Imran Khan, who is now the elected prime minister of Pakistan. And on our third trip, we took a sort of a side trip over to Afghanistan. And we had already been hearing about the Afghan peace volunteers. I hadn't paid so much attention. I thought, oh, this is maybe a government youth group or something. But we called on the phone, and then we began to realize who these kids were and felt great chagrin for not paying more attention. In fact, at one point, we were in Washington, D.C. with the Witness Against Torture doing a fast to close Guantanamo, and we learned through Bob Cook of Pax Christi, D.C., that youngsters in Afghanistan, part of this Afghan peace volunteer group, were in a pup tent on a mountainside fasting with us in the cold outdoors. And we thought, we have to meet this group. And so we did. We went to their province of Bamyan, three of us, Jerrica Arntz and David Smith Berry and I, and that began a relationship that has persisted till today. Those kids were, 10, 11, 12 years old then in 2010, and now they're wonderful 18 and 19 and 20-year-old youngsters who have accomplished great good even as they survive an increasingly terrifying war zone.
And you've been doing some interesting work with the mothers and with the children there too over the past 8 years or more. Could you just brief us on some of the work you've been doing?
Well, we were sort of stunned to realize that in the refugee camps particularly, people were dying of hypothermia. Babies were dying because it was just so cold and people didn't have money to buy fuel. They couldn't burn wood. They would burn plastic. The blankets were inadequate. And so at one point, we knew that there were women who wanted to be seamstresses, and they'd come over to where the Afghan peace volunteers lived, and they had a room, and they'd try to make products, but, they couldn't, their husbands wouldn't let them go to the marketplace, that was for sure, and they didn't really know how to make things that were saleable. And then we just realized all of a sudden, like a eureka moment, the mentor for the Afghan peace volunteers had hit on a brilliant project. He said, they can make the heavy blankets called duvets, like big, huge quilts, and we'll give them away for free. So we raised money across the United States and UK, and people were very generous. And women, every season, winter season, would be equipped with the coverlets and the wool stuffing and the thread, and they would make very heavy blankets. 962 women eventually were part of the project, and the blankets were distributed all across Kabul and in the surrounding area. And now the women are very determined to form a cooperative and work year round. And meanwhile, there were other families that couldn't feed their children, and the children were out being the laborers to earn an income for the family. You know, it's so ironic the United States is engaged in constant surveillance of Afghanistan. And I say, you want surveillance? Check out what the teenagers do when they go up the mountainside and they survey the widows. And when they meet a widow whose main income is coming from a worker under 12 years of age, then they ask that woman, look, could you allow your child to stop working for half the day, and we'll compensate with beans and rice and cooking oil, and your child then can go to school, but we'll tutor your child and get your child ready to be a good student. And they give the children clothing and book bags and teach them, basic hygiene kinds of things. And they've written their own textbooks, and they are brilliant teachers. And this is called the Street Kids School. And a few months ago, the first group graduated after being with the school for 3 years, and now 100 new kids have been taken in.
Wow, congratulations on that, Kathy.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
You're listening to Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of episode 3 in the series. This is part 2 of my interview with well-known peace activist Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy Kelly, could you sort of connect with us the group that you have in Chicago that I believe coordinates this project, the Duvet Project and the Education Project in Afghanistan. Could you sort of tell us about your group and how it operates and who else is involved?
Well, Voices for Creative Nonviolence grew out of Voices in the Wilderness. When I was describing the group that went to Baghdad and stayed there through the shock and awe and tried to deliver 70 delegations worth of medicines and medical relief supplies in violation of the economic sanctions, that was Voices in the Wilderness. We changed our name in 2005 to Voices for Creative Nonviolence, knowing that we had not succeeded in lifting those economic sanctions. We tried hard, but we didn't succeed, and that we were beginning to focus on countries other than Iraq as well as Iraq. And so we kept the same arrangement that had served us well since 1996, which is that we never had a board of directors. We never had any kind of hierarchy within the organization. We tried very hard to be egalitarian. Nobody took a salary, but we would accommodate people in terms of free room and board who were willing to move in. And in the beginning years, for the last 8 years of my father's life, also willing to help take care of Dad. And that had worked out so that my family said, oh, yes, Dad's pension, which wasn't huge, and his Social Security, which wasn't huge, would combine to cover the rent and the food. And so my dad got good care. We lived cooperatively. And we were also a place of welcome to lots of other people who came through Chicago. And we regularly had people dropping in who lived on the block and might want a place just to be welcomed for a while. So that was all well and good. We've continued. We've been fortunate in that after my father died, people in the peace movement have been wanting to see this keep going, and it has. We try our best to organize projects that are worthwhile, both with regard to Afghanistan, but also, for instance, we're deeply troubled by what's happening in Yemen. And so at the end of this week, we'll go down to the Federal Building Plaza in Chicago and set up 44 children's book bags in memory of each of the 44 children who were just on a school bus, on an outing that they were excited to be part of, and they had just been given UNICEF book bags as part of the outing, and they were excited little kids. There's video of them on their bus jostling and squirming. And
Kathy Kelly, will that be construed by the federal marshals? This is at the federal building, you're saying,
in Chicago. Yeah.
Will this be construed as a nonviolent action, which there's no real problem, or will they say that you're using their property for your own particular actions that are illegal? What do you suppose they will say about that?
Well, we did. We filled out the permit application, and I don't think that they'll say we can't be there. We will have placards, and I didn't put those on the application, but I have a sense that we won't be run off the plaza in this instance.
Now, this sounds like an activity, a direct nonviolent action that a lot of people would say, okay, that's all right. But when actions occur where there is blood spilled on property, missiles are wrapped on, and that all of the actions that the government feels that is destructive, property destructive, that eventually some people say is counterproductive because people don't like this. They don't like that. They say it's spitting in the wind. I've heard the comment that said that, this is breaking the law and that some other tactic should be used rather than those particular direct nonviolent actions. What is your feeling about all that, Kathy?
Well, I'd like to be welcoming of every tactic to accomplish social change and building a better world. I don't think one tactic is better than another, but I surely wouldn't dismiss nonviolent direct action as a valid tactic. You know, the United States has three branches of government, legislative, judicial, and executive. And how can we bring our case before the courts? You know, we really believe that we represent the right to assemble freely for redress of grievance. And we've got grievances. I mean, the wars that have claimed the lives of countless people who committed no crime, who meant us no harm, constitute a huge grievance. And the redirection of vitally needed goods and resources to build more of these hideous weapon systems and monstrous war machines constitutes a grievance. So yes, I should bring that grievance before a judge and sometimes before a jury of my peers. And if that means that I might be imprisoned or fined, well, you know, I just say add it to the tab if they assign a fine. And I'll go to prison as the Reverend Dr. King encouraged people to do, openly and hopefully lovingly. But I won't relinquish my right not to kill. I have a right not to kill. I won't be conscripted into the mafia in Chicago, and I won't be corralled into supporting the war machine. So I think it's also good to do legislative work by, you know, supporting lobbyists who lobby on behalf of peace and social justice. It's good to know the names of the bills, the numbers of the bills, to be in touch with elected representatives. But sometimes it's good to stay inside their office and say, you know what, we're not going to leave this office until you pledge to take your responsibility to end the wars.
Kathy, we're really honored to be able to speak to you. But before we leave, could you sort of give us your particular vision? What do you perceive out there is that has to happen or should happen? I guess also this would weave right into what your hopes are. So your vision and your hopes, if you could sort of give us your views along those lines, we would really appreciate it.
Mm. Well, I do believe in community, and I think that community is best understood as a means toward an end. And so I may not be the one to reap the harvest in this community of sorts, but I do want to be part of planting the seeds. And I think we have a responsibility to try to create intergenerational community, wherein there is a sort of an entrusting of the challenges and what's been learned by one generation to the next generation. So that's part of my hope. Now, I find these days that the most receptive young people I encounter are young people in Afghanistan, for instance. And that makes sense, that they're in the part of the world where they don't know if they'll survive United States militarism and United States overconsumptive greed. And so they are very interested in hearing about alternatives. My hope is that people who are relatively secure in their world, whether it's within academia or in a faith-based community or in some kind of a niche where they, you know, are not going to be wondering, how am I going to get my next meal? Or how am I going to, you know, pay for housing? I'm hoping that people who are relatively comfortable will sort of boost the risk level they're willing to take right now in terms of confronting a world almost gone mad on warfare. You know, I draw a great deal of hope from the fact that back in 1968, in the city where I right now am sitting, people were adamant that they wanted an end to war, specifically the Vietnam War. And my hope is that we can begin to see that until we build a united resistance to the permanent warfare state, there can be no rational discussion of solving our other problems. We have the wherewithal in the United States, with our $717 billion annual military budget, we have the capacity to feed a hungry world, to eradicate disease, to get a grip on solving the ravages of climate change. We have the capacity to make sure every young person graduates without any debt from any advanced learning institution. We have the ability to do it all. And we could also uproot ourselves from the entrenchment of the prison industrial complex of mass incarceration. We could begin to undo the abuses of police brutality and detention of people that try to migrate to this country. There is so much good that we could accomplish, but we can't do any of it and still maintain the demonic suction cup of U.S. militarism. We have to build a united resistance to the permanent warfare state. We're very far off track from doing that right now. We need all hands on deck within the university communities, within the churches and the mosques and the synagogues, within all manner of community organizing, grassroots efforts. We need all hands on deck to recognize that the fundamental problem we have to solve is how to stop the U.S. military from stealing, thieving, taking our hard-earned wealth and our resources and commandeering it for purposes of destroying other people and taking other people's resources.
Thanks so much, Kathy Kelly. Nonviolent Direct Action podcast will be continuing to investigate this whole business of why some people like you, and so many others really, have decided that it's time to go beyond writing letters to the editor, writing viewpoints articles, and even visiting legislators. It's time to bring the issue to the people. And so we thank you very much for doing this. And I hope that other people will begin to realize that they don't necessarily have to be a two-time nominee to be of the Nobel Peace Prize, to be an activist and to do direct action. But we surely appreciated you giving us this excellent outline of how you evolved as a person who maybe was somewhat apathetic or maybe ignorant of what was going on. But then something triggered your action that many of us look upon as not only justified, but honorable. So we thank you for your honorable actions, Kathy Kelly.
Well, Jack, thank you for listening, and thank you to all of your colleagues. I know that you and I have friends in common whose tutelage has meant a great deal to us, and so my thanks is extending very, very far right now after having had a chance to respond to your kindly and your thoughtful questions.
You're listening to Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of Episode 3, and this is Part 2 of my conversation with well-known peace activist Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We're going to round out this hour with a portion of a speech Kathy Kelly gave in Syracuse, New York on July 16, 2018, entitled, Let Yemenis Live, Ending U.S. Complicity in the War Against Yemen.
But I agree with Ali that oddness in our time might not be such a bad idea. To be countercultural in a time when there are many forces that would like us to believe that war is normal, would like us to believe that imprisoning babies is normal, would like us to believe that there could ever be a norm in which a child is too hungry to cry, that there could ever be a norm in which
people fleeing drought in one area of the world go to another area of the world, can find no food, no medicine, no water, and the elders are eating the trees. No, 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 it can't be normal. So how are we to understand Yemen today? I'm going to ask you to indulge me in something that's pretty idiosyncratic, but it is my entryway into trying to understand more about Yemen. I am somebody who has seldom watched TV. I haven't had a television since I was 17 or watched it. I mean, for those of you my age and above, I thought Farrah Fawcett was a plumbing company. I just knew nothing. But when I would watch TV, it sort of knocks me off my socks. So being dutiful before giving a talk in Manhattan College, and then later I was supposed to go to the New York Catholic Worker and be in front of my peers, and I thought, I better really, you know, bone up for this talk. And so I watched President Trump's speech to the Senate and the Congress shortly after he was elected, and this was in 2017. And I had actually never seen him on television or heard his voice before, and the next day I couldn't get up. I was just laying flat. And then I finally thought, well, I better, you know, put one foot out of the bed and start kind of recouping. And I think part of what had so confused me about that particular talk was that President Trump had done what most presidents do when they give a major address. He had invited somebody to be in the gallery whose story would be so emotionally gripping that it would kind of back up or put forward, accelerate something he wanted to get across. And so he had in the audience the widow of a Navy SEAL, Chief Petty Officer Ryan Owen, who had just recently been killed in the line of duty. And the woman was so recently bereaved that she could barely keep her composure as he identified her, and then everybody, it was so strange to me, stood up and started applauding. They gave her a 4-minute standing ovation, and the cameras were relentlessly focused on her, and she was trying to keep from bursting into tears in her grief, and Ivanka's hand was on her shoulder, and President Trump was shouting over the applause, "You know he's in heaven, you know he's looking down at you, you know he'll never be forgotten." Never was there any mention about where Chief Petty Officer Ryan Owen was killed. He was killed in Yemen. And it happened that in a very remote, very rural area of Yemen, a town called Al-Khayal, the Navy SEALs had been assigned to try to find somebody allegedly with Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula. But it was a raid similar to ones they've practiced many, many times that didn't go as expected, and so when they landed, all hell broke loose. The people in the village and their kinspeople in surrounding villages came running, and they very quickly disabled the helicopter that the Navy SEALs had arrived on, and they were kind of trapped. And so they called in air support. It's 2:00 in the morning, and all of a sudden, in a mud hut where two women were huddled with 12 children, a missile tore through the hut, a big explosion, and the mother of 6 of the children, her name was Fahim Mohsen, had to decide, do we stay and wait to see if we get hit again, or should she shepherd the children out of the hut? And she chose the latter, and as soon as she had her infant in her arm, one arm, and was holding her 5-year-old's hand, she stepped outside, and she was immediately hit. Perhaps a heat sensor picked up her presence, and she was hit by a bullet from a helicopter gunship and died instantly. The infant mercifully survived with just a scratch. Her 5-year-old was the witness to what had happened. And that night, in the village of Al-Khayal, there were 10 children under 13 years of age who were killed. 6 mothers were killed. But the only life mentioned, and there wasn't even a geographical identification of where he was killed, the only life that seemed to matter was that of Chief Petty Officer Ryan Owen. But to this day, there are orphans, and there are children without mothers, and there are families bereaved. And this is something people in the United States, I believe, would care about. Indifference kills, but it's an indifference fed by an inability to know about what is happening. And that's the kind of exceptionalism that I believe is very dangerous, and it jeopardizes people's security all around the world and even in the United States. I want to talk about Change Square. In Yemen, at the time of the 2011 Arab Spring events, there were a group of people who truly deserved to be called the Arab Spring. You know, Thomas Friedman recently said that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman represents the Arab Spring, but I don't think that's true. I think we need to refocus on the actual Arab Spring that was developing in Yemen. And it was brilliant. Young people, students in a very concentrated center of academia and art and literature and history, a city called Taiza, were gathering and they were doing graffiti art and videos and dance, and the young women had formed in their culture, in obeisance to their culture's habits, they had worn red caps and white caps to form the flag of Yemen and marched en masse. And there were people who were beginning to make good alliances with other people, with herders and with ranchers and with people who had perhaps never marched in any kind of political action before. And they were identifying the grievances. They were raising the lament. They said, we don't have water. The water table is going down. Drought conditions threaten us. We don't have jobs. The fuel subsidies have been cut back. People are pouring into the cities and the sewage and sanitation systems can't assist them. And the money is still being controlled by cronies, by people who've had power far too long. And they called for the exit of Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had been a dictator for 33 years. Well, it seemed like they were getting somewhere. They managed to get, for a 125-mile walk, 200,000 people to walk together. And they held their discipline. They were nonviolent throughout that time. And then, even though 50 were shot in Change Square, where so much of their idealism was centered, they still managed to maintain their nonviolent discipline. People had been sniping at them from the rooftops, but they stayed strong, they stayed together. And then there were numbers of them that were put in prison and possibly tortured, and their response was to hold a lengthy fast. These were incredibly brave students. But when it came to a time when the Gulf Corporation Council, the Saudis, and with the advice from the United States met, they said, okay, Ali Abdullah Saleh is going to go. He's gone. But it wasn't a change in policy. It was just a swap. They took his deputy minister, a fellow whose name is Abu Rabdu Hadi, and he was not elected. He was appointed. And he is now still called the legitimately recognized president of Yemen. But he doesn't even live in Yemen. He stays either in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia or in South Yemen, but he's not a legitimately elected president. And the young people's views and hopes, their efforts were sidelined almost completely. And those who had aligned with them started to say, you know, this nonviolence doesn't seem to be working too well, does it? And the civil war broke out. Now, the Saudis then decided in March of 2015 to join that civil war. And I'd like to spend some time together with you thinking, how can a war cause cholera? Cholera, the contamination of people's water with fecal matter? Well, one of the first bombings that the Saudis undertook, their bombings included bombing hospitals, mosques, buses, roadways. They bombed people that were gathering for weddings, for funerals. They bombed schools. But one of the first places they bombed was a sewage and sanitation center. And they wiped out the major crane for that center. And the workers came to work the next day, and they weren't sure how they could ever keep the center open, but they were doing their best. And the next thing they knew, the electrical facility that fueled the center was bombed. And so they weren't able to conduct the sewage and sanitation operations they usually did, and they knew that this would mean that people would be drinking contaminated water. Well, then there were more and more people fleeing to the major city of Sana'a because their areas were being bombed. They couldn't get the sewage and sanitation center up and running again, and that began the spread of cholera. And to this day, there are now 1 million people identified as suffering from cholera in one of the largest epidemics the world has ever seen. Now, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman went on Saudi TV and he announced to his population, time is on our side. A prolonged war is in our favor. Once every 10 minutes, a Yemeni child dies. Once every 2 minutes, a Yemeni child succumbs to severe acute malnutrition. Time is not on the side of those children. But Mohammed bin Salman has found alliance. When he came over to the United States, he was met by every former president, by Oprah, by media groups. He was treated as royalty, as though in this country that fought a revolution to say there's no such thing as royal blood. Suddenly the royals are in and human rights are out. And so who benefits from supporting the royals that believe they have a right to take over other people's land? Well, they're not so far from us. The people who are coordinating Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Dynamics, and who is controlling the United States Congress and Senate, those incredibly well-heeled and powerful lobbies. And so it becomes very, very difficult for any person to speak up about what is happening in Yemen. That doesn't mean that there isn't some pushback, and I think we should be very, very conscious of those who have said there's something desperately wrong in continuing to fuel and fund a war against people in Yemen who mean us no harm, who have threatened us not at all, people who are suffering desperately, and the United States is supplying billions and billions of dollars worth of weaponry.
You've been listening to Episode 3 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy. And this has been part two of my interview with well-known peace activist Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You can subscribe to Nonviolent Direct Action on iTunes. Thanks for listening.